You know that feeling when your day finally slows down and you just want to relax, unplug, and feel good? That's where Mood.com comes in. They're changing the game, delivering legal THC products right to your door, no shady dealers, and absolutely no medical card required, just good vibes and better sleep, shipped straight from their farm to your couch. From delicious THC gummies, smooth vape pens, to premium THC flower, Mood has it all. And everything's federally legal under the 2018 Farm Bill. Yeah, this isn't some loophole. It's the real deal. Head to Mood.com and use code FIRST20 for 20% off your first order. That's MOOD.com. Find your mood.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Hello and welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm one of your two co-hosts, Katie Halper.
And I'm the other of the two co-hosts. Do I need to say that? Is that redundant? I'm the other co-host, Matt Taibbi.
Yeah. Welcome. Hi, Matt. How are you?
I'm all right. Lots of stuff going on in the world. I'm not watching the RNC. I can't do it.
Oh, my God. Well, I'll be able to update you on the best parts of it. It's pretty intense. Yeah.
I mean, we are going to watch together the finale.
Right.
I couldn't, after the DNC last week, I kind of had my...
Your full fail? When you hear this, we will have already watched the finale and it would have been great.
Right.
But yes.
Right. We're in this weird space-time
right
now.
Yeah.
Lots of other stuff going on. Obviously, mass protests everywhere. The Jacob Blake shooting. Bit of a confusing story there. I'm seeing today all sorts of conflicting reports about what actually happened but obviously horrible
paralyzed. He's paralyzed, which is, you know, who would have thought getting shot 7 times in the back?
Right. Yeah.
Would paralyze someone. Yeah. I guess the miracle is that he's alive, but yeah. Wow.
Right.
7 times in the back.
I mean, I hate to say this, but in the annals of police misconduct shootings, that's not a terribly high number, 7. I mean,
when you're that close,
there have been incidents where there are 50 shots, 44 shots.
Right. Amadou Diallo. But aren't they usually far? I mean, again, I just think.
Not necessarily.
Like that close?
Yeah, we've had there have been incidents where police have finished firing and reloaded.
Within the distance of they could be touching the person.
You know, in like a hallway. Yeah.
Right. It's not like a competition. I do think it's different when you're literally, and I'm not saying like the other ones in the hallway were okay, but there's something different about it when you're like right behind them.
Right.
You know what I mean?
So the four food groups, Democrats suck, the Republicans suck, isn't that weird, isn't that terrible? There was a lot to choose from for Democrats suck this week. I just went for something that I thought was, it's getting to the point where it's so absurd that we got to talk about this before it becomes an all-out trend.
Right.
Dan is not here this week. We have our different producer, Reed Dunley, today. Reed, can we take a look at the story called Markey Bros? So here's the story in the Boston Globe. This is this hotly contested Senate race between Ed Markey and Joe Kennedy. Basically, this is an exact repeat of the Bernie Bro accusation, except it's coming from Kennedy this time at Markey. Kennedy's people are demanding that Markey, quote, publicly and clearly denounce the hateful conduct and speech of Markey supporters.
Well, can I just say, as someone who's a Markey supporter, I would like to tell Joe Kennedy and his campaign to go fuck themselves.
Yeah, you can do that.
There, I said it.
Rita, if we could see the next story, which is campaign decries what it says are Markey's toxic, dangerous online supporters.
I fucking hate this guy. I can't. I'm trying not to be toxic, but okay.
Basically, what the Kennedy campaign says is, we know that none of this is coming. None of the online abuse, and some of it apparently had to do with jokes about dead Kennedys. I mean, come on. There's a freaking band called Dead Kennedys. Right. Like, it's, you
know, but that's a death threat. They're considering that a death threat.
Well, apparently there were some. They're claiming that there were some threats mixed in there, but they're saying up front that none of this was actually coming from the Markey campaign, but it's a result of the quote toxic online ecosystem that he fomented. So, I mean, I just thought this was worth mentioning because this is now officially a thing where a way to get at or to change the subject in a campaign between two people who can't disagree over substantive issues is just to talk about somebody saying something mean on Twitter, even if it has nothing to do with the candidate. And journalists are very complicit in this because, you know, if you report this story at face value,
right,
then you're kind of creating this goo around the candidate who supposedly has the toxic mob. And it's completely a matter of characterization. Like, if you look at the reports about Sanders, you know, for years, it was about his toxic online following. But then if you look at the K-Hive stories,
yeah,
one after another talks about how what a brilliant, you know, strategic engagement policy she has and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And it's just infuriating.
As you said, we saw this with the Bernie thing. And as you said, it's when you can't critique the person on substance. So you have to make it about these like weird Twitter only disputes. And again, it's totally selective. Like, I'm a bit obsessed with this. I've documented a lot of cases of this. Nobody says anything when it's done by supporters of the person you're supporting, right? So right. No one says anything about K-Hive. No one said anything about Hillary Clinton supporter in 2016. There were two physical attacks based on the primary in 2016, both committed by men against, by Hillary men against Sanders women. And nobody who cares about sexism and toxicity, somehow nobody talked about either one of those. So it's a totally disingenuous smear that's occasionally regurgitated by good faith people who don't know that they're just parroting talking points. And again, if you think, and we are in a pandemic and you somehow think that this is the most important thing, people are being mean on Twitter. But if you want to make that your issue, fine, but you need to be condemning it no matter where it happens. But I just want to give really quickly an example of the toxic behavior that that the Kennedy campaign alleges to have to deal with. Okay. So this is like the nerdiest thing. Just reading at Boston Magazine, there was an event. It was a star-studded Broadway fundraiser that was going to happen for Joe Kennedy. It was going to be a Zoom thing, but it was shut down. Okay. Because of toxic attacks, apparently, according to the Kennedy campaign, against the people who were participating in it. Right. And here are just some of the toxic attacks from the Markey bros, okay? And everyone, if your kids are around, then cover their ears, lock your doors, all that stuff. So here's one of them, ready? And these are from Markey supporters, I guess, who are writing to the performers in the star-studded event. Hi, Andrew B. Feldman. I saw that you were participating in Broadway for Joe Kennedy, and I wanted to make sure you knew that the person that Kennedy is running against is actually the author of the Green New Deal and has been fighting for youth for decades. I'm happy to talk more in DMs. Okay?
That's the toxicity.
That's an example of toxicity. Here's another one. Ready? This is to Harvey Fierstein, another performer. Do you realize that Ed Markey supported gay and lesbian employment non-discrimination legislation in the MA in the Massachusetts State House in the late 70s? Seriously hoping that this is just an error in judgment because Ed has always been a progressive champion and not just when it's fashionable. It gets worse. Can't really shake my disappointment about this, Harvey Fierstein. I'm a huge fan. And I'm so grateful for your work. But lending your star power to help Kennedy unseat one of the most progressive leaders in Congress while we need to focus on beating Trump is just saddening. Another woman wrote to Sarah Bareilles, I have been your biggest fan since I was about 6 years old. Your decision to support Joe Kennedy and to partake in this is profoundly disappointing. I mean, I don't even want to think about the PTSD that these performers were subjected to. Harvey Firestein. I mean, I don't know if these guys are going to be able to recover from these vicious, toxic, absolutely bro-ish. They're just dripping with testosterone, you know, like these people who love Harvey Firestein have been fans of his forever. And they're these toxic Harvey Firestein bros are just aggressively rubbing his face in Ed Markey's great record they're Markey shaming. And I just don't know if this kind of aggressive, macho, bro-ish, you know, boorish behavior, I don't know if anyone's going to be able to recover, any of the performers.
It can't be countenanced.
Yeah, it cannot. This is the type of thing that ruins people's lives. And this is why people don't come out of the closet as performers, because they're afraid of being performer bashed and bullied.
I mean, it's preposterous.
It's preposterous.
And again, the fact that anybody turns this into a news story is what encourages the campaigns to keep doing this, because they know they can get a couple of days mileage minimum out of this kind of stuff. Journalists will bite on this.
They
love Twitter-based stories. They love being able to delve into all this stuff. So
Kennedy he runs us like this underdog, okay? And it's so pathetic. This is what his campaign said when the Boston Globe endorsed Markey over him. They said, "If you are one of the Globe's disproportionately white, well-off, well-educated readers, the past few decades have been pretty good for you. The status quo has delivered. Ed Markey has done just fine. But if you are one of the hundreds of thousands of normal working people in this Commonwealth, if you are black or brown, if you are an immigrant or a veteran, if you are sick or struggling or suffering, you know that business as usual isn't working." Okay.
Sorry, that's coming from the Kennedy?
Yes, that's coming from the Kennedy campaign. Because Kennedy is a black, brown coal miner who has not been able to pay the bills or make ends meet. And also, what was the thing that was like?
You're parasailing in Buzzard's Bay and you're frantically checking the share price of Mercury.
Yeah.
Look, you got a lot of stuff on your mind, you know?
Right. If you're sick or struggling or suffering, you know who kind of noticed that maybe was Markey when he supported Medicare for All, which Kennedy, who's younger, and by the way, I like the way he tried to age shame Markey. He's younger. He should be more in touch with this than anyone else. Kennedy didn't even support Medicare for All until he was like pushed into it. And oh God, I wish I had this on me. He actually voted for something for Trump. He voted to give Trump the right to do something. I can't remember what it was. Maybe like increasing the budget. And he literally said like, oops, that was accidental. He couldn't even stand by it. Mm. So anyway, I think, you know what, Matt, though? I want to say something. Look, it's easy for you and me to dismiss representation, I think, because we are not part of a certain demographic that Kennedy is part of. And that is, it's really easy for you and me because we're not gingers.
Right, yeah.
And there is a severe shortage of gingers and underrepresentation.
I'd gladly be anything, but anyway, yeah.
What'd you say?
Nothing. No, you're right. I'm not a ginger. I would love to be one, but
I used to want to have red hair so much when I was little. So yeah. So the thing that Kennedy suffers from is ginger phobia. And we have so much non-ginger privilege that we're just blind to that.
That's probably what it is. Yes.
That's probably why the Globe didn't endorse him.
Right.
That and because he represents the voiceless redhead, black and brown coal miners.
Multi-billionaire coal miner. Yeah. What do we have for Republican side?
So for Republican suck, I wanted to share this little gem. It's from the RNC, and the woman who's speaking is named Abby Johnson, and she is kind of a born again, I guess. She used to work at Planned Parenthood, and this is what she said.
Later in August, my supervisor assigned me a new quota to meet, an abortion quota.
This is at Planned Parenthood.
I was expected to sell double the abortions performed the previous year. When I pushed back, underscoring Planned Parenthood's public-facing goal of decreasing abortions, I was reprimanded and told, "Abortion is how we make our money." But the tipping point came a month later when a physician asked me to assist with an ultrasound-guided abortion. Nothing prepared me for what I saw on the screen. An unborn baby fighting back, desperate to move away from the suction. And I'll never forget what the doctor said next. Beam me up, Scotty. The last thing I saw was a spine twirling around in the mother's womb before succumbing to the force of the suction. On October 6th, I left the clinic, looking back only to remember why I now advocate so passionately for life. I founded and currently run And Then There Were None, a nonprofit organization that's helped nearly 600 abortion workers transition out of the industry. For most people who consider themselves pro-life, abortion is abstract. They can't even conceive of the barbarity. They don't know about the products of conception room and abortion clinics, where infant corpses are pieced back together to ensure nothing remains in the mother's wombs, or that we joked and called it the pieces of children room. You see, for me, abortion is real. I know what it sounds like. I know what abortion smells like. Did you know abortion even had a smell? I've been the perpetrator to these babies, to these women. And I now support President Trump because he has done more for the unborn than any other president.
But Donald Trump, it's kind of neither here nor there, but he's definitely not pro-life, Donald Trump. I mean, he governs like he is, so it's kind of a moot point. But it just...
He's changed his mind about that. He was pro-choice once.
I'm pretty sure he's pro-choice.
Yes.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Right, right. Or he's changed his mind about it, you're saying, to be generous?
Yeah, I mean, no, he publicly was at one
point. Right, yeah. And I'm sure he still is. Like, I don't think he's not one of these, like, look, there's a lot bad about him, but he's not particularly evangelical, born-again-y, religious, even though he says he's a very strong Christian. But a lot to unpack there. But first of all, beam me up, Scotty. First of all, no, she's a liar. That woman's a liar. There's no way they're like, we get money from abortion is how we make money. Especially because they're always bragging about how only 3% of their budget goes to abortion. And then I wasn't in the room, but I really doubt it. A doctor said, beam me up, Scotty. Also, her description of like the twirling spine succumbing, I don't know if that even works. And then the baby parts room, and then they have to put the baby back together again. And then she founds a nonprofit, or I don't know what it is, an organization called And Then There Were None, which is like really funny because like an Agatha Christie callback anti-choice group is just like,
right.
Like, you know.
Yeah.
So many levels and so many layers. But what I liked about that is that didn't have to be at a Trump RNC. That could have been at any RNC.
That's right. Yeah.
Right?
Could have been. Yeah.
Yeah.
And right. It was not particularly Trumpian at all.
Right.
Actually. There wasn't really nothing Trumpy about it.
Right.
I would have been interested to see how that monologue would have come out if Trump had delivered it.
He would have. I mean, I could have seen, been like, I heard about beautiful babies, unbelievably beautiful babies.
Through the tubes. I mean, his narration would have been.
He's back together. Beautiful babies. Unbelievable. I can't even. Look, and then he said,
it's terrible what they do to these little babies.
It's just terrible. You can't imagine it.
I'm going to go ahead and disagree that it's unimaginable that a doctor would say, beam me up, Scotty.
What does that mean though? Beam me up, Scotty. Like
he's about to suck the fetus up through a tube. So he wants to beam him up just like Scotty in Star Trek.
But beam me up, Scotty is asking for like, that would have to be if he was talking from the perspective of being the wand.
No, he's personifying the fetus and
Oh, he's speaking for the unborn fetus. Yeah. Oh, the fetus is saying, beam me up, Scotty. I get it.
Beam me up, Scotty.
Right. Because definitely if you are an abortion provider, you want to think of the fetus or zygote you are removing as you definitely want to personify that thing.
I mean, who knows what kinds of, I mean, look.
Right.
Oh my God. I'm pro-choice, but that is like next level gross humor that I don't even think I could go there. Actually.
Hey, I'm an unborn child. Beam me up. Scotty, that's the idea that the doctor is making fun of. Okay.
Yeah, I mean that's like Sam Kinison times Gilbert Gottfried.
That's so stupid. It makes no sense. That makes no sense. Beam me up, Scotty, says the thing that I'm about to remove.
No, it makes sense. Beam me up, Scotty. That's the joke.
But I get that part. But like, you see, it is funny. But Scotty is the unborn child. It's the unborn child who, by the way, Dems are so good on this issue, except one of the three religious figures at the end of the last DNC was like this woke pastor who was mentioning everything right and talking about, you know, all the intersectional things and everything and said a lot of good things about trans lives and Black Lives Matter, and then throws in an unborn baby in the womb or something, mm-hmm. which was interesting. But okay, now I get it. Beam me up, Scotty. That's like so stupid though. I thought it's so dumb.
It's hardcore. Let's just put it that way.
Thank you for defending the right. Who will speak for the abortion providing borscht belt humor? Star Trek based.
You can think of a better line to say in that.
Let's do that. But in fact, listeners and watchers and viewers of Useful Idiots, please send us your best fetus jokes.
I believe it's exit stage left. Or isn't that terrible this week? I just wanted to talk about. I now have retroactive shame for pain that I have caused countless young people over the years. So the headline, this is from The Mirror, which of course is the world's best source of news about anything, really. I mean, that's my go-to news source. Full stops intimidate young people as they're, quote, too abrupt or angry. This is obviously a British publication, so full stops means the punctuation mark we would call a period. And if we could read just the lead here. A recent study claims that young people are intimidated by full stops using social media communication as they're interpreted as a sign of anger. Teenagers and those in their early 20s who are known as Generation Z because they've grown up with phones and technology, is that the reason why? Tend to send shorter messages with very little punctuation. So when full stops are used in text, younger people often perceive it to be passive aggressive and a sign of irritation. According to The Telegraph, Leiden University's Dr. Lauren Fontaine tweeted, if you send a text message without a full stop, it's already obvious that you've concluded the message. So if you add that additional marker for completion, they will read something into it and it tends to be a falling intonation or negative tone. Then if you go down, there's a whole series about an argument between researchers and apparently a writer tweeted, older people, do you realize that ending a sentence with a full stop comes across as sort of abrupt and unfriendly to younger people in an email chat? Genuinely curious. So I guess using all those punctuation marks,
it's violence.
Thinking about the sheer quantity of all that punctuation, we're talking about billions and billions of periods, right? So if each one of them is troubling.
Yeah. And so the idea, but why would that be passive aggressive? Like, it's just like curt and short. That's the idea.
Yeah. I guess it's more informal if you're doing it without the punctuation. So it's upsetting. If somebody feels like they have to include the punctuation,
it's really serious.
Yeah.
See, I feel like that's just aggressive.
It's just aggressive.
Not passive aggressive.
So no more punctuation at all.
I'm just saying it's more convincing or more consistent in narrative.
I think this goes well with the Markey story. Like it's not just that they sent those tweets.
Oh, we should go count the number of periods in them.
Maybe they all those sentences might have had periods at the end.
Right, too. Which is double the violence.
Right.
I hope Harvey Fierstein didn't have to read that tweet himself. I hope he only heard about it.
He had to read each one of those sentences and have it come to a period and then restart the whole process until it comes to another period.
And you're just waiting for the next period. Like, right. You know, it's like you're waiting for the next shoe to drop because you know that this is the type of person who abuses, who uses punctuation.
And each time your person is being negated every time.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah.
You're being aborted.
That's terrible. We shouldn't laugh at that.
I'm sorry. Well, yeah, I mean, it depends. Look, it depends. you're right. We shouldn't laugh at people being triggered by periods. And there's a whole other, that's too much of a thing to walk into.
Yeah.
By people being triggered by punctuation. That's a serious thing we shouldn't laugh at.
What do we have for
isn't that weird? I was a little upset. I couldn't find very good penis content. I couldn't find it. I found some. It's not great. But this is interesting, actually. This isn't interesting. Isn't that weird? You know, we learned about a man who had a penis like attached onto his arm, which was kind of a big fail. But we can also learn other penis-based lessons, like the fact that, as Live Science reports, evolution turned this fish into a penis with a heart. Here's how. Anglerfish traded their immune system for systems for spooky fusion sex, new study suggests. And again, I'm reading at Live Science. When it comes to dating in the abysmal depths of the ocean, appearance doesn't matter much. That's fortunate for anglerfish, which resemble nightmarish fanged potatoes with a little reading lamp on top. And those are just the females. If you've never seen a male anglerfish before, you're not missing much. Measuring just a few centimeters long on average, male anglers are a mere fraction of their partner size and contribute a fraction of the work to their relationships. For many anglerfish species, the male's sole responsibility is to permanently latch onto an obliging mate, fuse his circulatory system with hers, then slowly allow his eyes, fins, and most of his internal organs to degenerate until he becomes what biologist Stephen Jay Gould called a penis with a heart. The man gets constant nourishment. The female gets sperm on demand. The anglerfish circle of life spins on.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
So basically it's a fish that's got, it's like penis hearted or what's the concept?
You're so penis hearted. It's like that Paul Abdul song. He's a cold hearted snake was actually originally, he's a penis hearted snake. Look into his eyes. It's really weird looking. I mean, it's literally like a parasite. It's a parasite penis.
I like the Stephen Jay Gould callback.
Me too. RIP. I saw him speak at Wesleyan. Very nice. His whole thing is about non-directional evolution. His thing was like, it's not all natural selection towards like the ideal thing. There are a lot of contingencies and randomness. And he said, you know, in history too, like the Battle of Gettysburg could have gone either way. It wasn't preordained or, you know, he compared evolution to the Battle of Gettysburg. Anyway, the big takeaway, by the way, from the DNC is that you have no policy, but you talk a lot about injustice. And the you know, the RNC officially is not changing its policy, right?
Its
platform or policy. Oh, okay. It's pretty brilliant.
Yeah, and, our platform is whatever Trump says.
Yeah, it doesn't. So that's great. And then... they also, Trump is a pretty good convention host. He naturalized about 5 people during the convention, which I think was a first. Also, you know, for all the people who were saying that Bernie was too radical, too much of a radical socialist, he would have been killed by Trump. And as friend of the show / enemy of the show, at least of Katie Halper's, personal enemy to me, Chuck Todd said, you know, the right is going to hammer and sickle you, Bernie Sanders. And lo and behold, the RNC hammered and sickled Biden and Harris. So it's, lest you thought that this was a safe way to go, because now Trump isn't calling the Democrats a bunch of socialists, radicals who are going to defund the police. Turns out he says that no matter what.
the comedy of labeling.
I know it gets my, don't get my hopes up, Donald Trump. Stop getting me excited about Biden.
Funny, because when they first named Harris the running mate, the Trump people sent out all these flyers, and it was like they couldn't quite figure out what their line of attack
right.
was
going to be. Right.
And they just, you know, they settled on Kamala Harris or Kamala Harris radical in
yeah.
the first day or so, which is totally not who she is.
No, it's not. Yeah.
And the again, I think we've talked about this before. It's weird because Trump, I think he won in 2016 in part by understanding exactly who his opponent was.
Yeah.
Right? Like, he stressed constantly that Hillary Clinton and Jeb Bush were pretty much the same person,
right?
Like, you know, politically, or at least the same kind of political animal. And for them to continue to be so tone deaf about who these candidates are is...
I think he's relying on her being a Black woman from Berkeley, though. I think he's like, he is trying to play up that, he's kind okay. of trying to fearmonger. I think he knows she's not that radical. I think like phony is probably his better zinger. What do you call her? Fake or phony?
Phony Kamala. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's him at his best.
I just think if you're Trump,
Well, what would you do if you were Trump? Like,
if I were Trump, I would be like, oh, look, it's the establishment rerunning the same campaign from 2016.
Nothing yeah.
changed. They haven't learned a thing. Like, that's what he was doing in 2016,
yeah.
and it worked. I don't know. It's just for
yeah.
reaching for these like ancient Republican
yeah.
cliches about
right.
socialists and the Democratic Party, and it's just it's weak stuff from
yeah,
him.
It is. You know? We expected yeah. more from him. The Hunter stuff, it's interesting.
This is how Donald Trump disappoints us.
Yeah, right. This is where, no, but another segment people will love, our fans will absolutely love, our haters will love. It's funny to see MSNBC totally lose its mind. They just like cannot understand how anyone would call out Biden's nepotism or corruption and his, you know, mention Hunter Biden. They just don't understand it when Trump has done that, has himself been a nepotist and corrupt. And because MSNBC doesn't understand basic politics, it's kind of weird because they're so smart, but
right.
they don't get that it's not against Trump's brand to be a nepotist and
right.
to be corrupt.
They're proud of it. Look, hey,
yes.
you know, it's like the bankruptcy debate with him. Well, why wouldn't I declare bankruptcy? That's the law
right.
to do it, you know?
Right.
Like, whereas if you're a Democrat, ostensibly you're ashamed of that. I know MSNBC is doing it. Do you think they genuinely don't get it? Or do you think that they're just...
I think they're like outraged and they just don't get how a Trump supporter couldn't care less about this stuff. Like
right.
they're also going really hard on how Mike Pompeo violated some law because he addressed, I guess, as Secretary of State, you're not supposed to address a convention. But again, it's like, I get that like Rachel Maddow, this is something that really, she's such a nerdy wonk and this really gets her, you know, what's the expression? Gets my goat, gets her goat or whatever. But
right.
like, who the hell, I just love the idea of people trying to motivate the base or like win back, you know, swing voters by being like, do you know what Pompeo did? Do you know the diplomatic history precedent
he
has ignored?
Of the State Department or whatever. Are you kidding me? Like,
yeah.
this is Trump. We should be happy they're not having human sacrifice.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just so funny. They just don't know they don't get it at all. It's like pretty funny to watch them. I think they get it on some level. They're the worst of both worlds. They have utter contempt for some people who they write off as deplorables and would, I think that they would easily say like, of course, Trump people don't care about corruption. They love that about him, but they also don't really understand how that works and how like no one cares if he's a hypocrite. That is Trump's kryptonite and it's his asymmetrical warfare weapon, which
well,
is that, yeah.
But he's not, I mean, technically, he's not a hypocrite because he doesn't profess to have the belief.
That's what I'm saying. Which lets him call out. And this is why I've always said that Sanders, I think, against Trump was uniquely well-positioned because, yes, he's calling him, he would have called him a socialist, but he's calling Biden that anyway via Kamala Harris, okay? And call him crazy, sure. But the thing that he doesn't have on Sanders is he doesn't have the hypocrisy or corruption, which he has on basically anyone, but definitely on Biden.
Right.
And he doesn't have the inconsistency. And that's something that even Sanders' enemies know because they say he's stubborn or they say he hasn't changed his ideas in 30 years. And, you know, I'm just saying that that is something that, of course, this is going to come up. And no one cares what Trump did with his own kids. When he calls out Hunter Biden, it doesn't matter because he doesn't profess to be an ethical guy.
Right, right. One last thing about the yeah. about the Republican messaging, Biden-Harris, which I think is interesting. If you go back to last year in 2019, when he was going after the squad and telling them to go back to Africa and all, or whatever it was, it was pretty clear that Trump was preparing to run against kind of the Bernie wing
yeah.
of the party, I think. And I think they, in a weird way, they have not recalibrated from that mindset, right? Like they want to be running against, I don't know if they want to, but they have conditioned their followers to this idea that they're going to be running against the squad. And, but they're actually running against Nancy Pelosi. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
And that disconnect, I think, is going to end up being a problem for them because the messaging is going to be way off.
But it's almost like the worst of both worlds too, because you have like Pelosi and Kamala. They are like, well, Pelosi literally right puts on a kente cloth, right? It's actually kind of perfect because it's like the elite, bad policies while very superficially kind of speaking about identity politics, but not helping people.
Right. Good stuff. All right. Well, we have a, do you want to talk?
Yeah, we are really excited for this week's guest, Zephyr Teachout. She is an attorney, an author, an associate professor of law. And she ran for governor, and she did in New York State, and she lost to Governor Cuomo. But honestly, she did pretty well. She got 34% of the primary vote, which is really impressive, given that she went up against a Cuomo.
She's sort of a big deal in New York politics.
And she is a progressive, and she's very anti-monopoly, and she's very nerdy, and I say that in the best way. Her latest book is Break 'Em Up, Recovering Our Freedom from Big Ag, Big Tech, and Big Money.
The book actually touches on a lot of themes that we've talked about with other guests in the show, including the author of the preface, Bernie Sanders, and Thomas Frank, who's another person. So she goes over some ideas that are really interesting, talks about some things that I think will probably resonate, especially with Sanders supporters, because she's very, very focused on like sort of concentration of financial power and the sort of lack of political will to do something about it. So
she also was a double degree person. She earned a JD from Duke University and at the same time a master's in political science.
Excellent. Well, this should be good conversation, and we're going to talk to
real overachiever.
So let's hear what she has to say.
Thank you so much for joining us. We're really honored to have you on. We've been wanting to have you on for a while.
Yep. I'm excited to be on.
Yeah, and Break 'Em Up, which is your latest book, Recovering Our Freedom from Big Ag, Big Tech, and Big Money. It's really good. Not just saying that. It's a good read. I guess the question is, not to start with a boring question, but what made you decide to write this book when you did?
I want to shake the shoulders of my progressive friends and tell them that we need to do so much more about taking on corporate power and not simply talking about the problem of corporate power, but like going at the root of power. And when there's so much that's exciting that's happening in progressive activism, but when it comes to like something so basic as trying to stop mergers or literally break up companies in a strategic way, moving beyond the moment of Occupy Wall Street. We're not doing it. We're not occupying the FTC. We're not marching in the streets. I know one politician who has anti-monopolist in his Twitter bio. It's not one of the core questions people ask. That's Ron Kim.
Oh, Ron Kim. Yeah. Great guy. I like him.
Like, it's bad strategy to not be doing this. And if you care about the incredible inequality, suffering, and destruction of our democracy, we have to change how we do our politics.
Do you think some of that has to do with the lobbying power of these companies? Like, in other words, if you go back to the days of Occupy, it felt like there was this tremendous amount of energy that was coming up precisely around all the issues you talk about in this book. But years later now, we're being told basically not to think about those issues, that there are other issues we got to worry about first. In the review of your book, in the Times, they were talking about how you might need to temper your anti-corporate zeal heading into an election season. Do you think it's the companies themselves that are kind of pushing the idea that this is something we should do later, not now?
Well, of course, that they are. But I don't think that's sufficient to understand what the issue is. And I think there's different parts of the Democratic Party that are influenced by this in different ways. I mean, another thing to answer both of your questions that really impacted me is I used to go to, I guess it was 2009, 2010, prior to Occupy, I went to a handful of Tea Party rallies. And sort of listened. And then I went and listened to Democratic leaders talk about the crash. And one of the things that was so striking about Democratic leadership was the refusal to be clear about who did what to whom, and a tendency to talk about this as a kind of a natural,
like a weather event.
Like, yeah, the forest just chopped itself down.
Right.
Nobody did it. Right. So to answer your question, Matt, I think that sort of for the corporate Dems, there is a really dangerous and bad for Democrats in general, and certainly bad for society, refusal to say, like, who is doing this to us? And so that was another motivation for writing the book, is saying, who is doing this to us? And then for progressive Democrats, I think some are so profoundly anti-capitalist that to say we want to break up big companies sounds like, and it's accurate, I'm still in a market economy. Like, the government's not making the shoes, the government's not growing the carrots. And I want to have a real conversation with progressive Democrats about that and say, okay, here's my vision. My vision is we have a market economy, don't have a monopoly capitalism. We don't have the profit maximization motive. But if you sort of fantasize about saying, if we can't even deal with these problems until we get rid of a market economy. First of all, that's a truly dismal understanding of politics, is saying we can't do anything about some pretty severe problems that it's pretty clear to me that we can do something about. And I guess I think that some on the left are not as engaged as I'd like to see in saying, okay, we can have a market and then we can nationalize some things and we can make things be public utilities, but we don't have to just wait for the end of the existence
capitalism
of
as we know it. Yeah.
Right, the end of capitalism as we know it, to address some like real suffering that's happening right now. I think that's part of it. What do you think about why this isn't happening more in the progressive left?
Well, I mean, you talk a lot about it in the book. I mean, I think some of it is just that some of these problems are too complicated. But I was really struck by the passage toward the end where you talk about that dichotomy, and you say that if you don't have this idea that companies can be wonderful or corrupt depending on how they're structured, then you won't have any enthusiasm for the idea of fixing them. Right. And that at the end, and I think you were talking about Michael Sandel, who had this dichotomy of either completely corrupt capitalism or nationalization, and we're not really talking about anything in between. I was wondering if you could expand on that a little bit, because I think that's really an interesting point.
My first title for the book, which didn't sell, was Who Will Make the Shoes?
Oh, I like that.
Because of conversations I was having with these amazing, and like, I'm so excited about activists that I'm meeting these days, who are really and correctly angry about the current state of affairs. But saying, okay, so who do you think should be making, what are situations where you think the government should be doing it? And what are situations where the states, so that's still the government, but a different level should be doing it? What are the situations where you think localities should be doing it? And then when you are talking about the private sector, like, how do you imagine that being structured? And I think a lot of the conversation is in the first half. Like, this is the thing I want nationalized. I want Medicare for all. I want an expansion of the VA. but I don't think it's... I don't think it would be good. And I think it's missing a huge part of people's lived experience to just ignore all the little parts of life that are actually a big part of life, which is consumer goods and the products that go into even the nationalized elements. I spent a brief minute talking about the Department of Defense. So you don't get more nationalized than the Department of Defense. Yeah. But you still need to break up the contracting industry. Because right now, these five contractors have a stranglehold backward on the Department of Defense. So if I love the Green New Deal model, I love what Markey and AOC laid out. But you could imagine a Green New Deal that says renewable energy and we'll just deal with five contractors. I got to tell you, that's going to end up eating itself. So you have to, even if you want nationalization in these big things, you have to deal with these gross, growing forms of private government that are happening in the private sector. So the bad news is we're in terrible shape. The good news is there's a growing progressive movement, but the progressive movement needs to fill out what its utopia is. And we may never reach it, but you still have to have some vision. Like, that's what we're going for. We're going for a more moral economy.
Well, how do you obviously endorsed Bernie Sanders. You were Sanders surrogate. He endorsed you. How does your view, and I know you're a major academic, and I'm sorry if I'm like dumbing this down a little, but your view of the world, how does that compare to Bernie Sanders' view of the world versus Elizabeth Warren's? Because there's so much discussion about like, yeah, well, she's the realist who gets markets and he's the utopian, but you obviously back Bernie, right? So why Bernie and not Warren, for instance? I don't mean that on a personal level, but right, I mean, like, what kind of ideology is it that you share with Sanders, and how does that differ from the more Warrenite conception of power?
Yeah, like, when it comes to particular laws that they would change in market structure, it's not actually that different. You know, like, when it comes to how you would have ag policy, or you would have... you know, how you would break up big tech. Sanders doesn't get enough credit for being an anti-monopolist. I love his intro, but I grew up in Vermont. I was there in 94, living there in 94 when he was running and protesting hospital mergers. So while he was calling for Medicare for all, he was still recognizing the danger of concentration within the hospital industry. And he has been on the forefront on ag, talking about how there's just this massive shift from in the last 40 years from what percentage of every dollar farmers are making and right. The asymmetries of power. So I think that he doesn't actually get enough credit in this area. When it comes to broadband, he's been amazing.
Yeah.
And he's a he's very much a movement person, which is what I think we need. I think we're talking about taking on some of the most powerful interests in world history, with certainly the biggest data sets in world history. So it's going to take movement politics. And I also think that one of the things that's so unusual about Sanders is he has this ability, and it's a rhetorical ability, and it comes from, you know, years of doing the work, to speak both to small business owners and to labor. And I actually think that's a really important joining. And I do think we can get there, if not to utopia, to a lot, to actually a moral economy. But I don't see how we can get there without those two joining forces. And there's very few people who can speak to both of those. Small business owners feel totally shut out of both parties, honestly.
When you talk about building a moral economy, you talk about specific sectors. We talk about ag for a minute, because you start off the book talking about the chickenization of America. And I think that I think a lot of people don't understand how the concentration of power in ag really dominates like small farmers, and they only have a few suppliers they can sell to, and they're all forced into these arbitration contracts as a result of that. Can you talk about what you mean by the chickenization of America and what the solutions might be?
Yeah. When I started writing this book, I ended up writing more about suicide and depression than expected. Because one of the things you learn pretty quickly is the incredible levels of despair that cut across the country, not just in rural America. So chicken farmers sound and look like they're free. They buy their own chicken houses. They ostensibly make their own decisions about how to raise their chickens. But in practice, if you're a chicken farmer, if your local distributor, which is going to be one of these big companies, either Tyson or Pilgrim's or Purdue.
And there's only three, right?
Yeah, right. And there's only three. There's actually a recent price fixing case where the law is coming down on them. But they kind of divide up territory in mafia-like ways. Like, yeah, you get this area, I get this area. If your local distributor isn't taking your chickens, that $1 million loan that you took out for your chicken house is coming due, and you are not—you're going bankrupt. So you need your distributor to take your chickens. So after Ronald Reagan and his California wrecking crew came in and just went purposefully, not just at deregulation generally, but at antitrust laws in particular, these distributors started growing, first buying up other distributors. So now we have only three. And then also buying up all the related industries, like buying the feed, buying the consultants, buying all the ancillary industries. And so the basic rule is, to be a chicken farmer, you can sell, and Tyson will allow you to exist, get your chickens to market, if you use their feed, their eggs, their lighting, their medicine, their consultants. They basically demand that you use everything of theirs. Otherwise, you can get cut off. That sounds pretty bad. But that's not it. They also require you to sign a contract that says you can't talk to your neighbors, and you're going to get paid a different amount every month. And the amount you're paid is going to depend on the pound of chicken you produce. But since you can't talk to your neighbors and you get paid a different amount every month, you don't actually really know what's going on. You don't know if you are producing less or more because the weather was bad, because Tyson is experimenting on you, because of the fact that you spoke out at a public hearing, and chicken farmers will tell you stories about, and this has been well reported, stories about retaliation for speaking out about this system. And so it leads to this rational paranoia, where you are right to feel like you are not in control of your own life, and you are being spied upon, and you are being treated differently, and life isn't fair, and incredible amounts of depression, and a debilitating anger. One farmer I talked to just talked about the dreams that he has and the amount of anger he has towards the distributors. And a real fear of speaking out politically. So this model is called chickenization. I got this from Chris Leonard's great book, The Meat Racket. He's a great investigative journalist. By the other meat industries, who are now chickenizing. So pork has gotten chickenized and beef has gotten chickenized. Basically, the distributors are like, this is a great model for us. We get to do the experimenting, we get all the data, and we can just treat these farmers like subjects. And I love the phrase, as dismal as it is, because of course the word chicken makes us all, it's all, right. all scared. Montesquieu right. talks about pockets of fear as sign of tyranny. Well, that model, that's the same model that Uber has. And that's the same model that Amazon has towards its sellers. And that's the same model that restaurant delivery apps are trying to build towards restaurants.
Well, and one point that I love that you made in the book, because it's so important, but I almost never hear anybody talking about it, is that it's also the model that the big tech distributors have with journalism, right?
Totally.
And you talk a lot in the book about something that for some reason, weird reason, is like a taboo in our business, which is that we're completely subservient to a handful of distributors. And the media companies are constantly scrambling to figure out what the algorithms are. They're subservient. It's a de facto regulator that decides how companies live or die. Can you talk a little bit about what you see is what's going on with journalism and their relationship to tech right now?
I mean, it is amazing that we allowed Google and Mark Zuckerberg to be basically the kings of our news industry. You would not select them, and you would not select any two people, no matter how good-willed. But we've allowed these structures that are will allow for two different things. One is just the death of working class journalism, working class news, and that had almost already happened when I wrote the book, and then the Daily News newsroom just closed down. Working class newspapers have always relied on ads. And the work that those journalists do, supported by ads, was getting shared and getting more eyeballs than ever on Facebook, but Facebook was taking all the money. Basically took out working class and local news across the country. And the pandemic hasn't helped because the advertising base has dried up even more. It's been totally devastating. And if that isn't enough, they are playing this king-like role where if Sheryl Sandberg gets together with Mark and says, let's switch up the algorithm and move to video, as they did, then all the newsrooms say, oh, the king says we got to move to video because we're going to prioritize video. So they fire their print journalists and hire video folks. And then Zuckerberg and Sandberg say, well, we don't like that. We're going to actually suppress all news. We just want to share pictures of cats. And so then the newsrooms say, what do we do now? And they start to rumble a little bit. And then Zuckerberg says, well, I'm a good king, so we're going to actually select some of you to prioritize. I mean, this Zuckerberg's solution, which was heralded as a solution, is that he was finally going to share revenue with news sources. A selected news sources that are then prioritized. This is an extraordinary move.
Yeah.
It's totally crazy that we're allowing this to happen. And I mean, I've been thinking about like, how do we organize journalists around this?
Yeah.
Because they've been weirdly silent and weirdly inevitabilist. And like, oh, that's the end of democracy. I guess there it goes.
Yeah, it's amazing. There's been almost no push. I mean, if you talk to kind of people who were in the business a million years ago when it was structured completely differently, some of them will complain about it a little bit, but if you've grown up in the way in this new model, it's almost like people have already accepted the idea that this is the way it is and the way it will always be. And it's just our job to react to whatever the changes in the algorithm are or whatever. And if they say it's, I mean, should there be unions? What's the response to that?
Well, I think publishers should march on Washington.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be amazing? So to his credit, Mark Thompson of The Times has spoken out, has gone to Washington to speak about it. While meanwhile, The Times is running as fast as they can away from this business model to a subscription model, which is good for The Times, but doesn't rejuvenate. And to his credit, he's very clear about that. It doesn't do anything for the Poughkeepsie Journal or the Daily News. So I actually think journalists have to speak up. Like, journalists are vitriolic when it comes to sunshine laws, as they should be. Now they'll say, we're not getting involved in politics. But if you don't have sunshine laws, if you don't respond to my requests, we are going to put that on the front page and we're going to shame you. And I think you should see a similar kind of journalist response. And if journalists don't respond, it's really hard for others to then come on board and respond. So I also tried to figure out, like, why hasn't there been more of that?
It's not part like of it. Is it part of it, like, the just that it's kind of wonky and wonkish and not that easy to understand?
Katie, the entire point of my book is that you were not allowed to call it wonkish.
I know, but I mean, but that's also why you had to write your book, right? Because, like, people do see it that way. I'm part of the riffraff that you guys get to experiment on. I'm just kidding, but I am part. I mean. Okay. It is true, though. I think that there are two things. There's the inevitabilist view of it. Then there's people not totally getting all of it. And then I think that there is a sub genre of people who in like out of their hearts may be in the right place, but they think that the way to be a good anti-racist is actually to like get Mark Zuckerberg to condemn things and not allow certain companies to advertise. And that's their kind of like woke response to it, and they don't realize that. I mean, I not sound like a broken record, but people are like, you know, want Facebook or Google or YouTube or Twitter to censor more, and they think they're doing that in a like progressive way. And as I always say, like, the most censored people are people critical of Israel, and especially if you're Palestinian. So, but there seems to be a disconnect.
You do not want Mark Zuckerberg to be your censor in chief.
Right.
He's a terrible privacy czar.
Yeah.
And you do not want that. And I think that people don't necessarily see the options that we actually can have a different model.
Yeah.
There's nothing inevitable about this. We don't allow our public libraries to be funded by targeted ads. And if they did, they'd be full of foreign and white nationalism.
Right.
And it'd be terrible places to go. And people would be shouting at each other all the time.
Right.
We allow this sort of basic public infrastructure, which is Facebook, to be funded in this crazy way. And that is wonky. I know it's a little wonky.
It's okay. We just have to be honest about it. And then we can translate it.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
But I actually think that I think what you're talking about, and I think that end of the story is a really powerful end of the story on the Stop Hate for Profit protests. I did an event with Brandi Collins, formerly of Color of Change, on this. She's taking a leave to write a book. But the Stop Hate for Profit campaign was basically saying, Zuckerberg, be better. And I have a whole chapter that's taking on the problem of boycott as a model.
Yeah.
But Zuckerberg really would be offer. Better. And it was as smart in terms of like organization strategy as you could imagine. It did a good job of highlighting that Zuckerberg doesn't just allow, but promotes. And I know that's hard, but chooses to promote and prioritize, racist content. So it's not just like even if you were a free speech model,
right.
it's choosing to lift it up. It's like your sidewalk chose to put little mics on the people who are saying the worst stuff. And so one is they did a good job of that. And then they got over 1,000 big companies, and all these big companies said, we're boycotting. And nothing happened. And Zuckerberg said nothing was going to happen and it didn't matter. And what Brandi said, which is right, is that that's why Congress needs to act. Like, they actually proved as clearly as you can prove that this begging model will not work. And while I was honestly quite critical when they launched, I actually think they did a really good job of proving that. So nobody can say, just boycott Facebook now, because the most powerful boycott just happened that got tons of attention, got huge companies involved, and it's like, nada. It is not going to change. So I hope that shakes people into saying, okay, now call Chuck. You know, like, your job is not to try to go off Facebook for a few days. Your job is to sit outside Chuck Schumer's office and say, why was tech not part of your anti-monopoly platform, and why aren't you doing more about this?
Yeah.
You talk a lot in the book about sort of the anti-monopolist movement, the history of it, and the actual one in our past, and sort of the concept of reviving it now. We had Thomas Frank on a little while ago, and he, you know, he's got a new book about the populist movement. And, you know, his thesis basically was that there is such a powerful propaganda reflex to denounce the very idea of populism as something dirty and illegitimate, and it makes people reluctant to get involved or to build a movement that sees itself that way. What do you think are the obstacles maybe to building that kind of movement currently? Because Sanders clearly seemed to try.
Yeah. Well, I love Tom Frank, and I am a populist. And I think that book is so smart. So I don't know that I can say anything smarter than what he says in the book about the obstacles. I guess what I'm trying to do is like just do more of the, we can all do more of the work of saying like, what are the shared experiences? And it's right out there in chapter one. It's like, if we can get Uber drivers and chicken farmers to march in Washington together, and I don't say that, but by showing that
to drive right. on tractors and in Uber.
Yeah, so. Right. But that like a lot of our stories have to be stories showing the shared, just outrageous experience that people have. That's a big barrier. Obviously, money in politics is a huge barrier.
Right. Well, that's a big question. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but that's a big one as we're heading into this election that's going to happen in a few months. And we've got yet another cycle where it's basically the same format, right? You have a Democrat who's trying to toe the line between collecting tons of money from corporate donors on the one hand and sounding like a person of the people on the other hand. Can that model continue and be successful, or do we have to just stop taking the money?
Oh, it's so hard. I mean, since I've run for office, I have a lot more sympathy. I love the counter examples that break through and gain a national funding base. And because of that national funding base are able to win. And then there's some people like, and there aren't that many examples like AOC, who is just a preternatural political communicator.
Right.
Who's like, did I pronounce that right? But the truth is, I do have sympathy for people who are running local races for a state house and are told if you only take low dollar donations, the only way to go is take low dollar donations. And if you don't only take low dollar donations, then basically like if you don't, you're a sellout. And I just gotta be clear. I have like, it's really hard to get the, especially with the lack of local news, it's really hard to get the energy. So I think there's some things like no corporate PAC money that are really, really important. I think obviously limiting the amount of money, like in New York, it's still grotesquely high, and making unilateral decisions about the amount are important. So I guess I don't actually think there's a single answer on that, Matt, because I think that there can be if we are going to win, and I want to win, my goal is to win, and that's to do politics, and politics is hard. And so I think it's plausible that somebody I'm trying to think of an example of somebody who's done this, but that if it's not all low dollar contributions in a local race, I don't think you write them off. I think you look at, my question for people is always like, have they challenged power? You know, is there some evidence that when they actually are in a position of power, they challenge power? And if they haven't, they're probably not going to when they get into power. Like that's not a typical
trajectory. Yeah.
But I guess what I'm resisting is I think there can be like a purity that says just totally out if there's any wrinkle. And I believe in politics, so I guess I don't believe in that. Absolutely. What do you think?
No, I don't know, actually. And I guess my next question was on that score was, well, okay, so Sanders was one of the only politicians who kind of got past that problem. He raised an enormous amount of money. I think he was the leading fundraiser by the end. And yet it just didn't quite work out in the end. Do you have a diagnosis about what happened with the Sanders campaign?
Didn't listen to Zephyr's op-ed. Sorry.
Okay, but I want to go back and answer your last question. On the presidential level, there's no excuse for not going to the dollar. Mm-hmm. I guess so. That's what I mean. It's like once you are at the presidential level,
right.
you can be low dollar, it's a choice. Like it's a campaign choice not to do that. And most of the attention you get is going to be our earned media. So do not make that compromise. So I actually feel pretty clear on that. Mm-hmm. And it's just I think it's much harder at the state level. I guess I was thinking about a local state house race that I didn't endorse in. And people were asking about one contribution. It's like, no, it's fine. So a diagnosis? Oh, gosh, I haven't even thought about that until I was so deeply embedded in every minute of it and then just stopped.
Well, it looked like he was going to make it there for a minute, but it was disappointing.
Wait, well, I think Zephyr's about to have a moment.
No,
I mean, fine. I see you. I was thinking
about what I was thinking at the time. And I think one thought I had at the time, but it's a little too self-serving or movement serving, is I just don't think there's any doubt that the pandemic played a role. The like anxiety and the sort of return to comfort moment was a part of that. That isn't everything. And I am not saying if there were no pandemic, then Sanders probably would have won, because that is not clear. Like it was always going to be a long shot.
Right.
But that was hard.
And you think it was too risky?
Yes.
At this moment, people were so risk averse. They wanted a return to normalcy and they thought that would Biden.
Is that it's about a feeling. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's part of it, but certainly not all.
What did you think about the media coverage of the Sanders campaign? Because it's
really maddening.
So maddening. Oh my God. Yeah.
I know. The other thought I was going to say is, you know, I don't want to be whiny about it, but it's really maddening.
Whiny, absolutely.
Yeah, why not?
It's like,
this is a safe space.
Take this seriously. These are sort of serious solutions to serious problems. And the framework was consistently like about outsider and it's really, really frustrating to be inside it.
Yeah,
I thought this stuff about, I worked for Howard Dean's 2003-2004 campaign with the beginning of I was the director of online organizing. Wow. And the hard question, they didn't want to do this thing, have people have meetings without staffers there. That was the big debate. Because people would say things that would hurt the candidate. So we had this like battle royale within the campaign about like, were people allowed to have meetups without staffers because they might go outside the talking points. And I thought that what we were doing is moving to a framework where if you have clear lines, then actually the less interaction you have, the less that the less people will be held responsible for the candidate.
That's really
that didn't happen. And the other thing that was true then was that people in groups often say things that hurt candidates less than people on their own. There's just a sort of a default conservative, small c conservatism in meetups, just because everybody sort of checks in with each other. Like, is this going to help our candidate?
Right.
Whereas atomistic language tends to be much much more like maybe really helpful and maybe totally destructive. So I think that we should hold candidates responsible for their own behavior. But the treatment of outliers and or supporters. And when the real examples were shown, it really was outliers. Like when you said, well, what exactly was said?
Oh, like the Bernie Bro, the toxic Bernie Bro stuff? Oh, yeah. I mean,
that was totally insufferable. It was bad science. It was bad reporting. It was bad journalism.
It was disingenuous. It was a fabricated narrative then people. Yeah, it wasn't true. And nobody ever condemned the stuff that happened to Sanders supporters of color. Sanders supporters who are women, all the vitriol lobbed at them / us were isolated incidents. Whereas anything in the other direction were all part of a greater story that was never actually proven.
Yeah.
Katie and I were just talking about they're doing it with
the marquee.
Yeah.
We read some of the really offensive things that were said that were literally policy critiques lobbed at supporters of Kennedy who were doing, like, for instance, they were doing a benefit, a Broadway thing. And the people, the cyber bullying was like, I'm really a fan of yours. I would love it if you reconsidered your support. Like that was the toxic, violent language.
So there's two things. One is there's a lot of toxic, violent language, and I've gotten a lot
everywhere,
don't love reliving it.
And
that policy debates are not toxic.
Yeah,
those like seem like really basic rules,
But this can become part of the standard political playbook now, right? In the internet age, it's been shown now with Sanders and maybe now with Markey that this is if you want to change the subject, you can just tell some reporters that issue a letter saying that they have toxic supporters online, and suddenly that's a news story. It's like you would never have been able to do that in the past. Although I guess they did do it a little bit with Dean.
But it's also on. There's the like nano micro level, but then they're even on the policy level. There's the like, how dare you critique this. This policy or position. In fact, my worry is that they're going to try to put Kamala in front of things as much as possible so that any criticism of said plan or position or policy will be like framed as sexist or racist. I think that having Joe Biden announce things, it'll be harder for them to try to like stifle criticism that way. So I think we have that to look forward to. But
I mean, I think it's not much of a, like, I wish we had a different nominee, but I am, like, all in for getting Biden elected.
Yeah,
I am not, you know, I really do think that things can get a lot worse. And and that there is there was that sort of really heartbreaking moment in November 2008 where Obama basically dismantled the grassroots arm that helped get him elected and said, I don't want your opinion on policy, and you're going to be an arm where we just push out news. And I was very critical of it at the time that it was going to weaken his power. It hugely weakened his power. And weirdly, we have the reverse possible situation this November. If Biden gets elected, which he does, which is that Biden did not have this mass grassroots of people who he can then shut off or say, who love him, who are going to say, oh, well, now he's saying to be quiet and wait, so we're going to be quiet and wait. But nobody's going to wait to hear what, you know, the like, grassroots energy is not going to wait for his permission to act.
Yeah.
So maybe I'm being a little Pollyannish, but that is the silver lining here. It's like, okay. There has never been a more make me change my mind moment. Okay, this is our organizing challenge. Can you impact the presidency with grassroots organizing? A sitting Democratic president with grassroots organizing. Well, we're going to try. And I don't think there's going to be a lot of hesitating, criticizing Biden. I take your point, but I don't actually think people are going to slow down on criticizing Biden, even with efforts.
That's what I meant. I meant like once they're in power, I'm worried that'll be used. But I do think actually I think Matt, you're probably, I'm probably just as much a pessimist about this actually as you are. But one of the slight rays of hope I think that exists is that when Obama came in, there was no more leftist like wing of the party that lost. Like, it's not like Obama beat someone who was further left, right? In this case, obviously Biden is it. And I mean, part of me is like, well, why would Biden move to the left now? Also, like, why would he move to the left if once he's president? Because we have nowhere else to go. He's going to take us for granted. But I do think, like, this little thing of hope is that there was this like taste of potential, actually more leftist like power, and hopefully that'll make people give people like the permission or the confidence in demanding more.
It's where the energy is. I mean, it's clearly where the energy is. So I treat this as a poker player. It's not that it's likely to be good. It's that it could be good.
Right.
And so, and the odds are good enough to stay in the game.
Right.
So it's not, you know, there's a lot of reasons for bleakness.
Right.
But, and I guess, so I am going to return this to the book, is that I guess what I want is I want to say, okay, if you are demanding something of a Biden-Harris administration, one of the things, the core things to demand is, yes, talk about policy, but you've got to talk about power.
Right.
So, like, if we're always on the frame of policy and gradually ceding power as these companies get more and more powerful, they can just, you know, give us $15 an hour this week and take it away next week.
Yeah.
So they're playing on the antitrust plane. They're playing on arbitration. They're all about hiring the best lawyers to make the worst arbitration contracts and hiring the best people coming from state AG's office to win every one of those cases. So, like, that's who we're playing against. So why are we not playing on that same field? Like, let Biden hear loud and clear that we are not going to see another Monsanto Bayer merger. We've got to unwind that. And if progressives show up for farmers on Monsanto, which is like, who loves Monsanto? Who loves Bayer?
Right.
that's an opportunity to not just say stop, but like, let's redo this thing so that you have better food and better treatment of workers and better treatment of farmers. Like, let's redo this thing together. That could create an alliance that is really powerful. But we've got to start doing it. And right now, like, the seeds are really exciting when they're there. Like, Pramila Jayapal is amazing on this stuff. And I don't think it's an accident that she's from Seattle. Like, she gets power. So Keith Ellison is amazing on this stuff. And he's got, I think, two or three staff on antitrust. You know, these, the state AGs have tiny offices, but nobody talks about corporate power as effectively as he does. So it's like, there are these seeds of incredible power analysis people. And then there's a lot of leftists who think they talk about corporate power, but in practice aren't organizing against it.
As a lawyer, is there a lot of reimagining of antitrust law that needs to be done because of the internet age, because the markets have changed so much? Like, in what ways is antitrust law maybe lagging behind reality?
So this is a major debate in our growing little anti-monopoly bubble. The truth is that our current structure gives enormous, enormous power to the FTC and DOJ. So that with aggressive FTC, they can rewrite the antitrust guidelines. And so that they actually have the power to, yes, Katie, this is wonky, but it's
okay. I enjoy that.
They have the power to basically effectively return to a structuralist approach, which says we don't want a lot of mergers. And if there's if somebody sticks around for 5 years and is still dominating in the market, we're just going to assume they're a monopoly that needs dissolving. So there's a lot of work that, this is why Biden-Harris matters so much, that that can be done. Having said that, if you take those cases to trial, I mean, Reagan's crew did a lot of damage. In appointing judges, creating precedent, which just took the heart out of antitrust law, and enforcers creating habits, and Democrats have done nothing. That's not true. Maybe a minute. In the last minute of the Obama administration, they started to do something, but they didn't change the default way of thinking about it. So appointing judges is really important. I just think that one of the things I would be pushing in Congress is just undo all the bad precedents. It's like, do you remember Lilly Ledbetter?
Yeah.
Obama's first law was undo bad statutory interpretation. Okay, so I've got six, and we have them. Everybody agrees on them. Not everybody. Most of us agree on them. Six bad precedents that make enforcing antitrust law harder. Just overturn them. Call it the Small Business and Worker Freedom Act. I don't know. But the, doing just overturning those precedents would do an amazing amount. But then to your question about tech, Matt, I think that there are some things about the data that's collected and surveillance capacity that do a few things. One is they make monopoly so much more dangerous. If you have Facebook acting like a little king over newspapers 30 years ago, that wouldn't be any good. But now they're a little king and they see all your metrics. And Amazon is filing a patent right now so it can see the full supply chain of its sellers. Like the level of surveillance means that we should be even more prophylactic than in the past. And then there's some things we shouldn't collect. Like, I don't like facial recognition. I think of it like we don't allow people to harvest their kidneys and sell them. I think that we should say there's some things that aren't sellable. So just brief thing on this. Really dangerous way of thinking about this that is coming up. The property law model. You'll hear a lot of people say these big tech companies have a lot of power, so people should have property rights in their own data. Sounds awesome, right? Just doesn't do anything. Because if you have property rights, but then can contract them away.
Right. Which you do when you sign up.
Right? Which you do.
Right.
So you're like, I'm a farmer and I have property rights in my data. And now John Deere comes along and says, as a condition of using this tractor, you will make sure I have the right to access all your data. Property law will not solve these asymmetries. So just don't, it sounds good, but it does not answer our problem. It doesn't actually help us.
Hmm. Do you have to go in and actually bar the practice? In other words, okay, that makes sense.
And bar the practice, anti-monopoly, and make some things, public. But as long as, or bar the sale, basically. Yeah, you can use the data yourself, but you can't sell it. Mm-hmm. Sort of like your MetroCard. You can't sell it. You can use it.
Right. You can swipe people in for free. You just can't charge them if it's unlimited.
Exactly.
Or regular, actually, too. Yeah.
But the reason people are going to property law is we have this sort of idea that like property law will give me the feeling of power again. But since contract law has taken over everything, like you can contract to anything.
Right.
It doesn't help that much.
It's like rock, paper, scissors. It'll your contract law will wipe out your property.
Yes, right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, excellent. Well, Katie, do you have anything else?
No, just if you consider that the subtitle of this could have been "Break Him Up: colon, Will That End Racism?" You know, a nice callback to the banks and racism, as if anyone said it would, and as if it's unrelated from that.
It's so related.
Yeah.
So we have basically had there's a tendency to look at merger policy, even though with the word merger, I know people roll their eyes or antitrust, they just like antitrust walks in the room with the word wonk attached. I get it. But this is not racially neutral. When you wipe out funeral homes through merger, you wipe out black owned funeral homes that have played a central role in every part of the ongoing civil rights movement. When you wipe out black-owned pharmacies through merger, or when you wipe out, as we are allowing to happen right now, 40 to 50% of black-owned businesses right now, because the CARES Act gave a bazooka to big white money and gave nothing to small businesses and people of color overrepresented in owning small businesses, that was not a racially neutral policy. And so it's like one of the things I do in the book is say, okay, so imagine the civil rights movement happening now. Who are the independent car owners? Who are the independent pharmacists? Who are the independent Black-owned business owners who would have supported it, because it's not SCI, which is now the conglomerate that owns the funeral home industry, and let alone the destruction of Black newspapers through Facebook and Google. So, yes.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, this is great. Yeah. And here's a book everyone should buy.
The book is really, I really like it. I think it's kind of, it's a great book for people who want to dig into the more specific ways they might want to think about changing the world as opposed to the general. I think it's really interesting and different from some other things that are on.
And you won't feel guilty, because it's not going to tell you to do pointless boycotts that or refrain from using something that won't have an impact anyway.
No, you can buy it on Amazon.
Yeah.
So that was Zephyr Teacher.
Yeah, Zephyr Teacher. That was great.
I learned a lot. You know, we should have asked her, what's she going to run for next?
I know, it's true. What is she going to run for next? Facebook. Yeah. What do you think?
Well, first of all, I think if Biden wins, there's a possibility that she'll end up
Senator of Delaware. Oh, no, that's not a thing. Okay.
No. I bet she will. I'll bet she is. I wouldn't be surprised if she ended up in the DOJ antitrust division.
Yeah. Biden, you're on notice. If you don't put her there, it's going to be a problem.
We should start talking about that topic, like who the potential cabinet type people
are. We should start stacking his cabinet, yeah.
I could see her in the DOJ somewhere, for sure. Or, you know, she could definitely another candidate to return to Congress. She seemed to hint at that.
Yeah.
She'd be great. Yeah, I think great. She's she was really outspoken in defense of Bernie this year in ways that I think some other politicians weren't courageous enough to do, which I think was really important. And the book is cool.
Is good. Yeah.
It's
it has a list of bad companies.
Like it's also pretty relatable. She swears in it. Like, you know, I think it's a readable book that I'm pretty sure she actually wrote. So that's
she did. Yeah. That's a cool book. It's a book. It's like part diagnosis, part manual. Yeah. And the big thesis is kind of like we have to break them up and regulate at the same time.
Right. And which is not really anything different than what Occupy was saying or what Bernie was saying in 2016. It's just that message has been kind of diluted on the Democratic side. Anyway, that was cool.
Right. That was great. Yeah. Check out the book. Subscribe to Useful Idiots. Like us, rate us, review us. Oh, I don't have my mug with me. I have another mug, but I got get the merch, guys. You got to get the merch.
Right. And if you're thinking about watching or listening to the Axe Files, drink bleach instead.
Yeah. It could help you with your COVID.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It killed two birds with one stone.
Yeah.
So to speak. All right. Yeah. We'll see you next week. See you in the next show.
Yes. See you soon. Bye.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.